Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Today, the man behind the question and the documentary, What is a Woman? It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? Welcome to Wednesday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review wherever you get your audio entertainment, Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. On today's episode, host at the Daily Wire and the man behind the new documentary, What is a Woman? That question has made its way to the forefront of the American cultural zeitgeist. It's a question that Matt Walsh asked several months ago on the Dr. Phil show. It's a question he points out in our conversation today that made it to center stage during the confirmation process of Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Jackson Brown. And it is a question that has confounded the proponents of gender ideology. The most empathetic among us, the quote unquote tolerant, what is a woman? A simple question that really undoes an ideology. Here today is Matt Walsh.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
All right, Matt Walsh, I'm happy to have you here on the Will Cain Podcast. You have traveled the world, asked this question of everyone you've come in contact with, including on social media. Have you found yet the answer, Matt, to the question, what is a woman?
You know, it feels a little bit like a spoiler, but I guess I can reveal exclusively that I did find an answer. It turns out that a woman is an adult human female, as it turns out anyway.
I don't want to give any spoilers either, but it turns out, as you point out, you didn't have to travel very far to find that answer. But the point of the documentary, which I thoroughly enjoyed, Matt, I thought it was very good and enlightening and entertaining, is your confrontation, I think, with those who would not or could not answer that question for you. I've watched you talk to psychotherapists, I guess. I don't know what type of doctor works in Planned Parenthood and prescribes puberty blockers. I've seen you now interview sex change doctors in Los Angeles. Why is it they have such trouble answering that question?
Well, I think that question, and by the way, they have trouble answering the question of what is a woman. What I discovered is that they also have trouble answering any other question at all. I mean, any question that you ask, if you're actually being sort of skeptical and you're asking a question because you want an answer, which is how questions are supposed to work, any question like that, they really have trouble answering. What is a woman in particular? I think it's because they know that their ideology has sort of backed them into a corner where there's no answer to the question that won't destroy the whole edifice that they've constructed here. Because obviously, you know, you can just look at the fact that a man says, I identify as a woman, and we're supposed to affirm him, right? As a woman, but then you ask, well, what exactly is that? What is a woman? And there's no definition that can be given that is coherent and objective, but also preserves gender ideology. And if you can't give the definition, then what does the statement even mean that I identify as a woman? And you end up in this kind of circular, self, you know, contradictory cycle.
You know, there's a moment, Matt, when you're talking to the subjects, and it's not really exclusively in your documentary. I saw the same moment when you were on Dr. Phil. There's a moment when you ask that question, you now being the proverbial you, search the eyes of the person that you've asked that question of. And I don't know, and I'm not trying to project or I'm not trying to dunk on someone, but it does seem there is a moment of fear. And maybe that fear is what you just described. Maybe it's the realization I've just been undone. But I'm curious, you know, do you think what you're encountering in that fleeting second, and by the way, it may be more in the documentary because it is edited. They maybe sitting there for minutes pondering the answer to that question. But if it is fear that I'm seeing, I'm curious, do you think they have never considered that question before?
I think actually, yeah, a lot of them. And one interesting thing you have to keep in mind when you're watching the documentary is that we were filming that over the course, you know, a lot of the filming happened. We started filming about a year ago and we filmed for, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months. But all of the filming was done. Most of it was done before my Dr. Phil appearance, and all of it was done before the, you know, infamous moment with Ketanji Brown Jackson when that question was asked on like the biggest stage imaginable, which means that for most of these interviews, this question was not really out there kind of in the mainstream. And so, yeah, the people I'm talking to hadn't really been confronted with it yet. And a lot of them, I think there was a moment where they stopped, and at first they're like, well, what are you asking me that for? And then there's this moment of, oh, yeah, I can't answer that, can I? And then that's when the evasion begins, this kind of like dance of trying to avoid the question, which is pretty interesting.
Can I ask you, I want to ask you about some of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. I want to talk more about the philosophy of gender ideology, which is the important part of this conversation. But as someone who also creates content for a living and does so both live and on tape, I'm really fascinated by both how you booked these interviews and what happens during the interview. I heard during your interview with the gender theory professor, and I can't remember what school or university where he taught, but I remember during that interview he said to you, oh, I saw that on the list of questions that you submitted and I was excited to answer that question. Did these people know who you were, Matt? Did they come in expecting some level, I don't even want to call it hostility, but of accountability? What were the expectations going into the interviews?
They knew the kind of broad subject matter we'd be talking about. And as you heard there in the interview, there was several of our interview subjects who asked to see just kind of a basic outline of the questions. Obviously, there were going to be follow-up questions and stuff like that, but just kind of basic outline. And we were happy to send them, and we did. I think that maybe one advantage that we had was that, yeah, I don't think that any of the I don't think any of the interview subjects we sat down with recognized me or had any idea really who I was. And that again goes back to, well, we're filming this, you know, starting a year ago, and this was before, you know, appearing on Dr. Phil. I kind of raised my profile a little bit in this film, and this is before all of that. So yeah, there was no, as far as I could tell, there was no real recognition or anything like that. The interesting thing you mentioned, like sending the questions ahead of time, is that there were instances where people were getting kind of tripped up on questions that they knew were going to be asked. And yet we're still kind of tripped up on, which I can't explain that exactly. I find it very fascinating.
What happened during the interviews? For what it's worth, Matt, after you and I spent some time together at The Blaze some 8 to 10 years ago, I spent 5 years at ESPN. And let me tell you one of the great things that ESPN did. They required every on-air talent to take an interviewing course. And it was really good. It was something that I would recommend any media organization to put their talent through this course. You learn things like ask, for example, open, benign questions. Don't lead the witness. Don't put them in a position where they can evade an answer by asking them a double-barreled question. Then they can pick and choose what answer they want to go with. Don't give them yes or no type questions. And you asked, especially with this particular question, what is a woman, an open, benign question. And it's amazing what that does to an interviewee. It really often, and not just with this question, spins people out of control. And I'm curious what happened during the interview, because most of the questions I saw during the documentary were in that spirit, open and benign, not a harsh cross-examination, not argumentative, not a debate, at least what was in the documentary, at least what made the cut. So I'm curious what happened during the interview. I know during one of them, the congressman cut the interview short, but how did most of the interviewees react?
I think that they, you know, things got actually pretty tense early on in the interviews, just on the strength of exactly what you're talking about, these kind of open, what would seem like rather benign questions. And that's another thing that I wasn't quite expecting. Now, I knew that I knew that the question, what is a woman, is a real stumper for people that are proponents of gender ideology. And so I was expecting, you know, that they'd be stumped on that. But what I found is that really much earlier than that, if you just ask basic questions, I think it's more, in fact, one of the interviews, I think it was the professor, he said something about, well, it's your tone. You know, he was disturbed by my tone in the interview, even though my tone was, I think, very, you know, baseline kind of just neutral. But it was clear that I was it's a real question. I actually want an answer out of you, and I don't want just like a talking point. And I think that's what threw them for a loop. But I also found the questions are important, but also, you know, silence is very powerful. Just like let them give an answer, ask your question, they give an answer, and don't say anything at first. Because then they'll kind of keep talking, and that's what I really want. I don't want the first sentence that you give me, because that's the talking point, right? I want give me some more. Let's flesh this out a little bit, and that's when I found things kind of spin off the rails a little bit, or in a follow up question. I mean, you know, the answer to what is a woman that we got from pretty much everybody, some version of it was always, well, a woman is anyone who identifies as a woman. And they kind of want to leave it at that. But then the follow up is, well, identifies as what? What is that thing that they're identifying as? What does that mean? And once you start bearing down a little bit more and trying to get, you know, actually get to the substance of this, that's when I think it all kind of falls apart.
Well, you're absolutely right about silence, by the way. I think they teach that in negotiation. Forget political debate. If you're negotiating over the price of a car, silence is incredibly powerful. People are so uncomfortable with it that they begin to feel silence, and you get more. You get more from your interview. And I know I can hear you. I can almost hear you asking yourself how much to give for the sake of spoilers. I'll just say everyone listening should absolutely go watch What is a Woman? It is entertaining. It is enlightening. So I'll let you still kind of balance and weigh that debate when I ask you this, but the congressman Tanaka walked out. Did anyone else end the interview early? I saw the professor threaten to. Did anyone else end the conversation prematurely?
The professor did end up at a certain point. He got up and just had enough of it. We had got to the final question of what is a woman. So at that point, you know, we got to the final question. The congressman was the only one that kind of that skipped out of there before we could even get to the final question, which is why I had to ask it as he was walking out. And we got that great answer from his aide, who was standing over my shoulder the whole time, by the way, who said you're never going to find out, which is just always a fantastic answer. And then we talked to a so-called gender affirming pediatrician who also threatened to walk out but didn't. And that's the other thing I discovered. It's kind of like this psychological thing, too, where people are really uncomfortable leaving situations. Like, they don't want to get up and leave. And so you got to use that to your advantage also. I mean, I'm not stopping anyone from leaving. You're perfectly fine to leave, but you don't want to. So I'm just going to keep asking questions. And that's the way it went.
I appreciate you entertaining that, because, look, I think we're all sort of attracted to the train wreck of an uncomfortable moment. And there are plenty of uncomfortable moments that sit and weigh heavily for the audience and for, you would presume, you two in the room. So I wanted to see how that played out in real life. Listen, you have made this really, I think this is probably, I would assume, Matt Walsh's number one issue, at least for the moment. You've written, as you point out, a best-selling children's book about gender ideology. You've now made this documentary. It's certainly, I think, probably the majority of the things now on your social media feed. Why do you find gender ideology such an important topic?
Because there's a few things. You know, one is that it's almost like I didn't really choose it. I think the left and the cultural powers that be, the institutions, have chosen this as their top priority, culturally anyway, you know, their number one project. So in some sense, it's I don't even look at it like I chose. It's sort of they did. But why is it so important? And the answer is, to me, it's so important because it cuts down to the basic question of truth. You know, it's like, are we going to have a society that's grounded in truth? Are we going to be people that have any concept of truth or not? I don't think you can have a human civilization devoid of truth. And that's another thing that happened in these interviews, is that almost every single one of them, at some point, including the just average people on the street we talk to, at some point, it devolves into this whole, Well, what is truth? Whose truth are we talking about? Those kinds of questions. Because you find that underneath the gender ideology, what they're actually interested in preserving and promoting is this kind of relativistic notion of we all have our own truth. Relativism in general. That's the real motivation, I think. And that's why I think it's so important to them, to the other side, is because, hey, if we can establish that even my biological identity is sort of up to me, like I'm this self-created being and I get to decide everything about my own identity, well, then I really do have my own universe, my own truth. And I'm sort of the god of my own galaxy in a way. And it seems to me that that's what they're ultimately shooting for.
You know, for what it's worth, I mean, I share your sentiment that this issue is one of the most important that we face, if not the most important, one of the most important issues we face as a culture. And the reason why is exactly what you just laid out. It is a question of whether or not we are going to recognize reality, an objective reality, or we're going to live in a world of subjectivism. And everybody, as you point out, gets to define their truth. That's one of the interactions you have in the documentary. What is your truth? There is no my truth. There is only a truth. That's a conversation you have in there. But you just said something fascinating. You think that in the end is at the top of the agenda. Gender ideology is just a pathway into denying truth and reality. But, you know, you said it, and look, I say it too sometimes. You said the left, right? We use the pronoun they, in this case, the generic pronoun they, and we talk about whoever it is driving this agenda, the left, elite politicians, elite cultural tastemakers. I'm curious, though, how much of this you think is driven from a top-down agenda versus how much is sort of embraced from an atomistic, chaotic ground up level? Because when you describe the value of subjectivism in my personal reality, I can see how as a culture we start adopting that from the ground up, because everybody wants to believe they're right and nobody can ever tell them they're wrong, and it's my truth and my reality. But how does that aid the left? How does it aid the left for every single person out there to live in a subjective reality?
The first part of the question, I think that it's really, at least at its origins, top down. That's where this starts. And it still is. I mean, as I mentioned, the people that we talked to on the street, yeah, there was a lot of apparent confusion, like asking these basic questions of average people. They would also evade and kind of dance around it. But it was pretty clear to me. And oftentimes there are a lot of people who aren't in the film because they told me that I just can't talk about this issue on camera because it'll mean that I'll lose my job and I'll lose my friends and all this kind of stuff. It was really clear to me that most of the people that we're encountering, they know the basic reality, but they're just afraid to talk about it. There's so much fear. And why are they afraid? It's because that comes from the institutions. That comes from up top. I mean, we talk about in the film the origins of some of these ideas. There are some kind of landmark moments you can look to, and also some pioneers of these things. We talk about John Money and Alfred Kinsey being two of the big ones. And that was back in the mid-20th century, right? And it seems to a lot of people, though, that the gender ideology thing really came along like 5 years ago. And that's why people talk about it like it just sprang out of the blue. And I think what really happened is that it kind of was bubbling under the surface. It was making its way into society through the institutions, especially like academia, and then kind of filtering down from there until kind of the groundwork was laid, and then it could kind of explode into the mainstream. But I do think this is a top-down move for the most part.
And by the way, I want to follow up on that question in just one moment, but since you introduced it, I found the historical origins of much of this, the focus on Kinsey and John Money. I found that fascinating. Lay that out to the extent that you can without, you know, doing the documentary on a podcast. Lay that out if you wouldn't mind. Most people have heard of Kinsey. They probably haven't heard of Money. They've heard of Kinsey because I think Hollywood turned it into a movie and he's just sort of seeped into popular culture. How did those two individuals advance this to where we are today?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, people have heard of Kinsey through Hollywood, but the thing is, if you've heard of Kinsey through Hollywood, then you haven't really heard of Kinsey, because that's not like the reality of Kinsey, who was really just a monstrous person and a fraud and just a quack. And his real thing, his goal was to sexualized children. I mean, he believed that children were sexual literally from birth. And that's why we talk about an infamous study that he did, if we can even call it that, where he documented the orgasms of young children down to like 5 months old. And he used sex offenders, child molesters, child rapists for this kind of quote unquote research. But this was his effort to, you know, kind of make it clear that we are inherently sexual beings from birth. And then you have Kinsey. Okay. You have him there. And then we have John Money, who now we're going over into the gender side of it. And he was one of the first people to come up with this idea that gender is something that people have. And people don't realize that before guys like Money, nobody talked about gender among people. People had a sex, male or female, man or woman, and gender was linguistic. Like, words had gender. You have masculine and feminine words. Money was among the first to say, no, people have a gender and a sex. And he coined terms like gender identity. I think sexual orientation is a term that he coined as well. And he came up with this idea that gender is fluid, it's socially constructed. And we talk about in the film, there's a whole story about how he kind of tried this theory out on two young boys, one of whom was quote, transitioned at the age of two after a botched circumcision, convinced the parents to raise the child as a girl. Because, hey, it's socially constructed. As long as you affirm him as a girl, then he'll be a girl. That's not how it turned out. Both the kids end up going on as adults to kill themselves. They were totally ruined by this being John Money's lab rats. But that's where these ideas came from. And, you know, from Alfred Kinsey, you have kind of the comprehensive sexual education that goes into the schools. And, you know, you got to start teaching kids at like kindergarten or pre-K about this stuff. That comes from Alfred Kinsey. And then from John Money, we have gender is fluid and everything that we hear about gender. And so when you hear people on the left say really anything about gender or in defense of sex ed in schools, they are parroting ideas from those two guys, even if they don't know it. And I think a lot of them actually don't know it.
And that, of course, gives evidence to the idea of what you said a moment ago, that it's driven from the top down. I'm curious, Matt, you've done this documentary and you see, I mean, I would say your documentary lands at a fortuitous time because the news cycle is focused on Pride Month, but I'm sure some of that was calculated. And the other thing is the news cycle continuously gives you fodder for it to be meaningful in that week. This week, we've got the Drag Your Kids to Pride event here in my town of Dallas. We got drag queens bumping and grinding and kids feeding $1 bills into their thongs in front of a neon sign that says it's not going to lick itself. And I'm just curious, when you see all of this stuff, Matt, like, where's it going? What's next? You have the historical context. You know where it started in the 60s and the 50s with Kinsey. Where are we 10 years from now?
I think for the advocates of this stuff, what their goal is, just, it's really the total destruction of, we talked about the destruction of objective reality. Also, any concept of kind of traditional morality, the parental, the parent-child relationship, the nuclear family, I mean, all these things they want to blow apart, blow the smithereens. And what we find on the left is that when you challenge them on these things, they just double down and become more radical. I mean, now you have Democrats and liberals actually coming out explicitly in defense of child drag shows. I just saw on Twitter, there's a state senator in California who came out just openly advocating for child drag shows. That's the kind of thing that 10 years ago would be unthinkable, even among Democrats.
Right.
So I don't think there's any kind of stopping the dissent for them. The question is, on the other side, the people that oppose this, are we going to get to a point where a line is finally drawn? I think there's some evidence that maybe we're reaching that point. I hope we are.
Well, maybe, but the inertia of progressivism within culture is really in fifth gear right now. I mean, as you pointed out, like 10 years ago, everybody on the left, almost everybody on the left, would have condemned a child drag show. So I just have to wonder, 5 years from now, maybe 10 years from now, where are we? You know, you asked the question in the documentary of one subject. You said, what if I said I'm black? So are we going to be in a place where there's such thing as, and I know there still is on the margins, but in popular acceptance, is there going to be transracialism? Is there going to be, and again, I know there still are people out there, and you bring it up again in the documentary, where we're going to say, well, you know, he believes he's disabled. So there's going to be a sizable contingent of people. More importantly, there's going to be a sizable contingent of apologists who say, yeah, you should cut off that person's arm because he believes he's disabled. You know, we can keep going. Transracialism, you know, furries or whatever, people believing their pets. And again, you've brought this up. I'm just curious, do you think that's going? We're in fifth gear. And look, the inevitable one that everyone talks about is pedophilia. Are we moving to a place? And look, we're already sexualizing kids because I don't consider this in the smallest bit conspiratorial. We're clearly sexualizing kids. So what will, which of these, go through them one by one. Which of these do you think we will, as a culture, be apologizing for within 5 years?
It would be a lot easier to talk about the one that we won't be, because I think all the rest of it we will. The one that we're kind of skipping, I think, is the transracialism thing. I think that that will, even though that of all these various ideas, being transracial is actually the least crazy, because actually you can be mixed race and those sorts of things. So race is fluid in a sense in that way. So if that's the least crazy version, that's the one we're not going to do. And that's just because it totally ruins. It just doesn't work with the intersectionality politics on the left. And so they're going to skip that one. But all the rest of it, yeah, I think we're going to see. Here's what I would say the next 5 to 10 years. I think a big thing, and we're seeing this now already, but increasingly being, quote, genderless is going to be a big thing in 5 to 10 years. There are people, there are surgeons now who will do so-called gender nullification surgeries, where they just obliterate any semblance of sex. They'll just get rid of your sex organs and try to turn you into this kind of genderless alien sort of creature. I think that's going to become increasingly popular. I think this proliferation of like made up pronouns, Z and Zer and Zem, that is more and more popular, especially among the, you know, younger kids, kids on TikTok and everything. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. Trans species, you talk about furries. This is already starting to bubble up and become more of a trend among young kids. So I think all of that is absolutely on the table. And the final kind of acceptance and defense of pedophilia, of sexual abuse of children, I think is also we're basically already there with the child drag show stuff. It's just a matter of how explicit and open are they going to be about it. And I think eventually, and not too long from now, we're gonna get there.
I asked that question on Twitter this week, like, what is our line as individuals, as parents, and as a culture? At once you have your child stuffing dollar bills into a stripper's, and I honestly don't care if it's a female stripper or a drag stripper. Once you have your 8-year-old stuffing dollar bills into a stripper's thong, you really have to ask yourself and look in the mirror, what is my line? Like, when will I stop? And I look at the parents at that kind of thing, and I think, I don't think there is one, Matt. At this point, it's clear. Like, if they can arrive at the place that this is a way to show your own virtue and achieve popular acceptance, then there's just too many of us who will go along and not tolerate, but encourage.
I think with the drag thing in particular, I mean, the interesting thing is to think of it this way. I mean, drag is, it's a form of burlesque performance. That's what it
yes.
is. It's burlesque for men who are cross-dressing. Well, okay, let's just imagine for a second, keep everything the same, and let's just imagine that the men who are dressed as women actually are women. So these are female burlesque performers, like what right. you would find in Las Vegas or something. And there were kids involved giving dollar bills out. Everybody would agree that's wildly inappropriate. Of course you don't involve kids in that. And yet if you make the performers male, all of a sudden it's okay. It just doesn't make any sense at all. But that's kind of the theme that we come back to. It's just that what they're saying doesn't make any sense.
Well, what's the handrail of sanity? Like, what do you grab to? What insulates the American culture?
I don't know if there's anything that insulates us. I think that we can talk about insulating. One thing that we can do to try to rescue our kids and eventually society is to try to insulate our kids more than we are from a lot of this stuff. And some of that means like, hey, don't give your 10-year-old daughter or son a phone with unlimited, unregulated internet access where they could be exposed to all this stuff and there's no way for you to control it. But I do think broadly for like society, I even though, as you say, we're in fifth gear and we're the momentum isn't on our side right now, I do think that long term, this is a winnable battle, gender ideology in particular, because as we discovered while we were doing the film, it just wilts away and falls apart under the slightest scrutiny. And the only way that it continues to have this kind of dominance is that the people who know better refuse to say anything and refuse to ask the question. So we just have to get the normal, sane, rational people. I don't care if you call yourself conservative or not. Normal, sane, rational. You understand the difference between man and woman. We need to get everyone in that crowd to just stand up and draw that line and say, this is too far. Reality matters. Truth matters. And that's it.
You know, I have a couple more places, Matt, I want to go with you really quickly. But look, I remember this from knowing you again, I think almost a decade ago. But also I keep up with your work. And I also saw Jason Whitlock offer this friendly, constructive criticism of the documentary, wherein he said, you didn't bring faith into the documentary. I know, by the way, that that's a huge part of your life and your worldview and your analysis of most things. But I actually agree with your choice to not tell this story through the lens of theology or faith because of what you just described, because you want to appeal to as many people as possible and make a rational, logical argument. And look, Matt, in the past, I have over-indexed in that direction. If I'm being self-critical and self-aware, I think I would have said my analysis of most of the world has over-indexed on a logical basis. I have to think that ultimately our only insulator is faith, because I don't know, and this isn't a criticism of the documentary, because I think you did it the right way, because if you had done it theologically, you could have been too easily dismissed. But ultimately, as a culture, I don't know if we can appeal to sanity and reality. We should. Don't get me wrong. We should. But I just see too many would-be intelligent people willing to divorce themselves from those things. And I just don't know if there's any other salvation. And look, my audience knows this. I'm a work in progress when it comes to faith. I mean, as we all are. But I don't know, Matt, if there is any salvation to this type of, I've seen Jesse Kelly say this. You may have said this. This is Sodom and Gomorrah level stuff to sexualize kids. I don't know if there's any salvation outside of reaching for faith.
I think it's not a either or. I think it's kind of a and also situation, because I agree with everything that you're saying, of course, as a person of faith myself. But I don't think we have to choose between truth and faith, truth and God. You know, I think that these all lead in the same direction, which is one of the reasons why, as you pointed out in this film, you know, we didn't end on a theological argument. We just wanted to appeal to the basic reality, the truth. And I think that truth ultimately all points in that direction to the ultimate truth, you know, the divine truth. And so if you can get people kind of on the road, then at least that's a little bit of progress. And then you kind of take the next step. But first, there's just no hope of that if people are lost in total mental obliteration and confusion. You got to rescue them from that first. And one way to do that is you cannot give them any easy outs. And that's a big reason why we didn't end on a Bible quote or something like that. Because if we had done that, then it just becomes, the left can say, oh, you see, this is just Christian. It's just religious. You have to be religious to disagree with us. And that's the escape hatch that I think they would have loved to have. We don't want to give them that. But once you can get people out of the confusion, and now it's time to take the next steps. I mean, that's why this documentary is only 90 minutes. You know, you can only do so much in 90 minutes. This is one part of the battle, but there's a lot more to be done, obviously.
Okay, just a few more places. Do you think you look? I know the Daily Wire is targeting young people and young conservatives righteously. Do you think in making this argument, in all the arguments you made, I'm curious how you see your project. Are you, look, take a guy like me, right? I come across a Matt Walsh tweet and I go, yeah, I freaking love that. That's logic. And it's harsh logic usually. And that's fair to say about a lot of your logic, right? I mean, it's plainly harsh.
Sure.
It's harsh in the way that the truth is harsh when it's laid out plainly. And by the way, you have your style is very interesting, Matt. And if you'll just grant me this little bit of opinion, I mean, you're really fairly neutral, like in your tone. For that professor to say, you know, I don't like your tone, you're really fairly neutral. You're very logic based, which to some people reads condescending. But I'm really curious. How do you think the project's going? Because your goal can't be to make Will Cain or those that agree with Will Cain or those that already agree with Matt Walsh to pump their fist, right? Ultimately, your goal has got to be to win over the winnable people to the side of sanity. Do you think What Is a Woman does that? Does the entire, and I don't want to limit to the documentary, the book, your analysis, everything. And you can throw, I'll throw myself in that as well. I mean, am I doing it? Are we winning over those who can be won to the side of sanity, or are we simply preaching to the choir?
I think slowly but surely we are, but this is a long term. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. You're also not going to produce one piece of content, whether it's a film or a podcast or a book or anything, and just, oh, the battle's won, right? I mean, we got to this point right now in our culture through the course of generations. And so logically, to get out of it, probably going to take generations as well. And we also know that the momentum, as we talked about, is not on our side. And that's generational. That's true generationally as well. I mean, there's been you look at the increase in trans identification in the youngest generation as opposed to the old, it's like a 10 or 20 fold increase. Right. And there's every reason to think that momentum will kind of continue for a while, but we could slow it down. And even with this film, just taking the film by itself, I really didn't know exactly what to expect. I thought that would resonate. I knew we had something that mattered and I was proud of. But it has already, from my vantage point, had more of an impact than I honestly thought that it would. And I've got a lot of emails and everything, reactions from people. Obviously, I can't even begin to read all of it, but just from what I have read and from talking to people, I've heard from a lot of people who tell me that the first thing they tell me is, I'm not a conservative, or I don't agree with you on most things, or even like, I really don't like you on almost everything else, but I really appreciated this film, and then going on from there. So
right.
I think that we've been able to connect with people on a broader kind of level.
I should say, by the way, you're harsh, but somehow you're also fairly comedic. I mean, in the documentary, you have pulled off somehow those two qualities in a way that I don't know that I can name another person. In fact, I'm sitting here wondering, like, were you purposefully comedic, or is it just part of your personality? But I'm not going to have you self-analyze there unless you want to. I'm going to end with this question, because we begin with philosophy. I want to end with sort of the philosophy behind this and the question I left sort of dangling. I agree with you that it's top-down driven agenda. So what serves the left, for lack of a better term, what serves those pushing this agenda down to have everyone at the ground level living in their own individual reality? What does that chaos allow? Greater control, greater manipulation? If everybody's out there living in their own truth, what does that do for those pushing it from the top?
I do think it gives greater control and manipulation to the institutions, because one of the things that it does is it fractures and separates people from their families, from their communities. Like I was saying before, kind of on the left, it seems like there's this project of just destruction of everything, just destroy the family, the parental child bond, religions, the churches, all of that. And if we're all in our own universes, then naturally it's like everything. It's like two stars are not existing in the same solar system. They are perpetually being flown apart from one another. And so I think that's kind of part of the advantage of getting everybody in their own little universes. And the other thing is when people live their lives that way, they are more easily manipulated, because then it's all about, they often tend to be driven by kind of base instincts, and they're pursuing pleasure above everything else. It's like everything is very me focused. What makes me happy right now in the moment? Nobody else matters. And when you live your life that way, then once again, you're very easy to manipulate. It's like a Brave New World. I mean, you go back to the dystopian novels of the 20th century, and you see a lot of insight into that, how people, when they get away from morality, when they don't have connections with their families anymore, when they're very me-focused, self-centered, looking back within themselves, it becomes easy to kind of control them like sheep. And I think that's what we're seeing.
Well, I should say also that the documentary is not solely full of interviews that are antagonistic. There are people in this that I know you've described as a hero. There is a woman who's transitioned to a man who's very passionate about what we're doing to children. And I think in the end, that's the story of the documentary. We've devolved into a culture who takes out on children our most perverse modern day senses of cheap virtue. And you also talk to a psychiatrist who's, I would have to think, a minority voice of sanity within that profession. So it's great. What is a Woman? Where can folks find it, Matt?
You can go to whatisawoman.com or go to dailywire.com. They take you to the same place and sign up for a membership and watch the film.
All right, Matt. I've enjoyed talking to you again. It's been a long time, but thanks for breaking down the documentary and catching up today.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, take care. All right, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Matt Walsh. You can check him out at the Daily Wire. And as you heard there, you can go subscribe and watch What is a Woman? I encourage you to do so. It's a really entertaining and good documentary about this moment in the American cultural debate. All right, my thanks to Matt Walsh, and I appreciate you as well for listening to the Will Cain Podcast. I'll see you next time.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.